So welcome everybody to the Injamara podcast. I'm Jack Jacobs, a research fellow here at CSU. And before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that we are on Ngambri and Ngunnawal country. So we gather here today in their presence and the presence of their ancestors. So thank you to be here on that land. We're joined here by four guests today on a panel to discuss where we are at with the campaign on enshrining an Indigenous voice to Parliament in the Australian Constitution. Our guests today are Michelle Graddon, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Professor Mark Evans, Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research at CSU, Professor Dominic O'Sullivan, Professor in Political Science at CSU, and James Blackwell, Research Fellow in Indigenous Diplomacy at the ANU and a proud Wiradjuri man. So we're 5 weeks out from October 14th, the big referendum. We're seeing a marked decline across all polls in support for the yes vote. Just this morning, the Resolve Political Monitor came out of the nine newspapers with support for the voice at around 43% and 57% of those polled saying no. Every state is on track currently to vote no according to that poll, except Tasmania. So the polls tell a story that is dire. I want to ask all of you with this opening question. At this stage in the campaign, is it that the no side is doing something right, or is it that the yes side is doing something wrong? Dominic, maybe we can start with you.
Well, I think it's both. What the no campaign is doing right is expressing its message very simply and clearly, and it's appealing to people's uncertainty. And it's able to do that because of what the yes campaign is doing wrong. And that is, it's not conveying a clear and simple message. It started in the polls a year or so ago with a commanding lead, and I think that encouraged a sense of complacency. There seemed to be a confidence that people would vote yes because it was a morally good thing to do. But people are looking for stronger reasons than that, and they're not coming through clearly. We saw Noel Pearson, for example, on the ABC yesterday with a perfect opportunity to explain why people should vote yes, to give reasons, yet in the course of that 20-minute interview, there wasn't a single reason for voting yes. And, you know, it's time, I think, for really succinct, short, understandable messages to come through from the yes campaign.
Michelle, you've been observing Australian politics for a very long time, and we do know that scepticism around a proposition to change the Australian Constitution tends to grow towards the referendum date. What is your sense on why support is falling at this point in time?
I think it goes to a very fundamental question, and that is that people are doubtful about changing the Constitution. And we've seen that, of course, historically with the referendum questions. Only some 8 of 44 questions have been passed. And I think that as the campaign has gone on, people have fallen back to that deep conservatism about constitutional change. At first, people were supportive of this general proposition, but then those long-term doubts kicked in. Moreover, I think also you've had the Yes campaign trying to get across a couple of messages which are contradictory. Yeah. One is that this is really a small change, it's not a big ask, and we should respond to it in those terms. On the other hand, the Yes people have argued that it can be potentially transformational. I think people see a contradiction in that, and that makes it difficult. The other thing is, when there's not detail, people say, well, what is this really about? Where does it take us? What are the consequences? On the other hand, I think that the No campaign has had the easier course because it can exploit those contradictions and questions. And also, as we know from elections, fear campaigns, scare campaigns are pretty successful. So I think it's a combination of those factors that have us where we are now.
Absolutely. I want to get to you in a moment, James, because you've been going around and speaking to communities. But just really briefly, Michelle, a lot of the stories we tell ourselves about where the voice is at are to do with polling, right? They come from where the news poll is at, or where what Redbridge is saying, or what the Resolve Political Monitor is saying. How much, in the case of an Australian referendum, should we trust the story that the polls are telling us?
I think it's interesting that there's been some scepticism about the polls, and that perhaps is understandable because of, particularly in 2019, they weren't on the mark with the election result, or most of them weren't. But I think that in general, on a proposition that in a way is as simple as this to poll, you're not getting down to what each party gets as you are in polls before elections, that they'd have to be very, very wrong not to be capturing opinion where it is now. It is important to say that polls are snapshots. They're not predictive, even though we tend to use them in a predictive way. But things can change, and of course we've got, a month or more to go in this referendum. But as things stand now, I can't see that we should distrust the polls. Mm.
A month or more to go, James. You've been travelling around the country. You're a Yes campaigner. You're a Wiradjuri man. What is the story that you're picking up from people on the ground? And where are you and your people at this moment in the campaign?
I think the big story for me in the towns I'm going into, that's mostly ACT, Victoria, regional NSW obviously, is there's a lot of undecided people. A lot of people who just don't know enough to commit one way or the other. A lot of people, you know, I'm not necessarily campaigning for a yes. I mean, I'm personally voting yes, but the events we're having are much more informational. You know, what is this? Where has it come from? Why is it important? Why are advocates advocating for it? And I think people are showing up to those with an open mind because they do genuinely want to know what this is about. I think, especially in regional areas, you know, they're not necessarily as engaged with some of the debates as they are in perhaps in the inner city, at least compared to living the, you know, those of us living in Canberra, or those others living in Canberra. So I think there's a lot of people who are undecided. I think hopefully we'll see them come around to the yes, but again, I think there is a significant chunk of people, at least from my own experience, are out there still just not sure what this is about. And that potentially is a failure of the Yes campaign, I think, with regards to not being able to clearly articulate some of the detail here. Mm. Some of the detail, of course, is only going to come out after the referendum, but there are some questions that we do know the answers to that just aren't being conveyed in a way that makes sense to people. So I think, you know, as a Wiradjuri person, our community, I think, is equally divided. And there are some Wiradjuri elders and communities who are very strongly in favour of yes, and there are some that are very strongly in favour of no. And I think that stems in part from some of the lack of detail and undecided nature of it. I think some of it in part stems from a distrust in government, you know, this kind of cynical view on can government really help us as Aboriginal peoples. But I think also the thing that links back to what Dominic and Michelle have just been saying is there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of deliberate falsehoods, mistruths, dare I say lies, that are being circulated around the Indigenous community, the non-Indigenous community, about what this is about, what this will do or don't do. So I think that's another thing we had to really contend with out there talking to people, is that a lot of stuff that's just blatantly untrue, and you spend a lot of time trying to kind of make up ground on that before you can even then get to, okay, this is what we're actually talking about. You're going to kind of have to cover across the field of, okay, it's not a UN takeover, it's not a secret ploy to take farmers' land off them, and then we can get to, okay, now this is what a voice is. Yeah, so that's been a real hurdle, I think, as well.
And we're going to get a bit more to the media environment a bit later and how that shapes this debate and conversation. But James, I'm keen to hear, what do you think is the key point that you think will have cut through with First Nations communities to get them to support the voice?
I think, for me, the thing that's getting a lot of traction to people I know, at least in the First Nations community, is this is not the end goal. This is not, we're not done at this point, you know. This is not going to be our, you know, the solution that fixes all of our problems. It's a step on the road to solutions. It's about getting us to a better place in the long term. Mm. You know, this voice is about getting us to a point where we can discuss treaty, we can discuss tree, we can discuss other issues. But we can't get there if we're still, you know, kilometres behind in terms of disadvantage. We're never going to get to that point to have fair discussions on any of our issues if we are dying earlier, not finishing school enough, you know, going to prison. Like, those things are plaguing our communities, and we know that. So I think for me, it's about saying to folks, this is not going to be perfect. It's not going to be the solution that fixes everything, but it's something. It's a start. I do believe it'll work. So I think that's really been my message to mob out there, is that it's not designed to fix all of our problems. It's designed to get us onto a road in which we can better advocate for ourselves and better see real self-determination.
Yeah. So zooming out from the local to the very global, Mark, you've been observing and been a part of campaigns around the world, thinking about how you win campaigns and referendums. What's the international evidence tell us here about how you win a campaign like this, particularly at this stage, this pointy end?
Well, the international evidence really tells us that the Albanese government didn't look at the international evidence. So there's five key observations that you can pull from the international evidence. The first is, keep it simple. A simple question with a clear call to action in the answer. In other words, you ask the question, what does the bumper sticker look like? And this is the case for the opposition. Don't know, say no. Right? What does the bumper sticker for the Yes campaign look like? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, Brexit clearly demonstrated that you don't make assumptions about public knowledge and opinion. I mean, the reality is that Labour has a failure rate of 96% in leading referendum historically. Polls are not a proxy when things are close. And actually, there has been a fragility of the polls in terms of the size of the samples, even in the polls reported this morning, and in terms of using online polls as well rather than telephone polls. And we knew from the Warren Gasser Mission Festival early on this year that there was a clear disjuncture between the views of a lot of Wiradjuri people and what we were told through the big national polls. Thirdly, around the world, parties are no longer the key mechanism for issue mobilisation. So even in Australia, if you look at partisan de-alignment, you know, they carried, 34-36% of the vote in the last election. So building coalitions of interest is absolutely critical to winning a referendum. And then coming back to the point that was made by James, public education is critical, right? Now, this government spent 1.5 million ahead of the 2023 referendum, $1.5 million on enabling a country to reach a history-making decision. I mean, seriously? So again, public education is absolutely critical in relation to this. And ironically, next generation voters through civic education, because there's a big program, as you know, through civic education on referendum. But that's not actually going to impact on this poll. And then finally, the other observation is really that referendum is a way of solving major constitutional questions, essentially when you've got the high bar of double majorities, is increasingly old-fashioned. So countries around the world are increasingly designing what I call in the book Saving Democracy, participatory governance systems. So in Ireland, for example, they started with a constitutional convention and a citizens' assembly, and that laid the ground, basically, for referenda that happened later and legislative debate in the parliament as well. So referendum is a one chance constitutional changing device, so old fashioned when we look at what's happening in terms of democratic innovation across the world. So complacency, absolutely, Dominic, completely agree with that, but also a lack of basic reflection on what the international evidence tells us around what works.
Michelle, I just want to talk to you about the politics of this for a moment. So it's a strange situation where you do have First Nations people campaigning on either side of this referendum. To what extent do you think this has become a red-blue issue, if you like, in Australia, between Labor and Liberal?
Oh, very much. There's no doubt about that. But on your point about having First Nations people on either side, I think that that simply complicates it for voters who are not totally engaged in this, because on the one hand, the government and the Yes people are saying that most First Nations people support this, or at least they're saying they overwhelmingly support this, and yet you've got the No campaign led by high-profile First Nations people. So that is a factor that makes it harder for the Yes case. But on the partisanship aspect, obviously it's high stakes for both the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. And once the Nationals and then the Liberals came out against it, even though there are people who've defected on the issue and are campaigning for Yes from the Liberal Party, I think that that made it just very, very hard to get this through on what we know at the moment. And, of course, the stakes are so high for each leader. And I think while the wisdom was in the beginning that the stakes were higher for Peter Dutton, I think now it's quite clear that if this goes down, then Anthony Albanese really has a knock to his authority, especially with his colleagues, because I think they will say, no doubt privately, that we've wasted a lot of time on this. It's deflected us from other issues, and what was that all about? Now, it may not, in the longer run, affect Labor in the polls, but I do think it will affect the Prime Minister's authority, and also it will leave a very, very bad void, a lot of resentment and anger and disillusionment by Indigenous people, and the government will have to have some sort of plan to deal with failure if failure comes.
If failure does come, Peter Dutton will see it as a victory. What do you think it will mean for his standing within his own party?
Well, I think it'll be difficult for him to manage in his own party, in that the party has been split over the issue, not necessarily 50-50, but of course we saw Julian Lisa, the Indigenous shadow Indigenous Australians minister, defect to be a Yes campaigner, still a Liberal, of course, and there are other high-profile Liberals. And so the unity of the party will have to be resealed, as it were, and I think it'll go down very badly in teal seats for Peter Dutton. So there are consequences, serious consequences, for him as well as for the Prime Minister.
Dominic, I want to think closely about two of the claims made by the No campaign and to see what you think about them. One of them is that this referendum will divide Australia in the name of reconciliation. How would you, as someone sympathetic to The Voice, I believe, respond to that claim?
Well, I think one has to ask, divided from what? Dividing Indigenous people from a society that for over 200 years hasn't really wanted them. So it's an odd conception of division, and to try to relate it to reconciliation, I think, carries an intellectual flaw and inconsistency. The Yes campaign's counter-argument is that it could be better expressed. I see it as an opportunity to include people in the policy process. To say quite explicitly, this isn't our white fella state and society and government. It belongs to everybody, and this is an opportunity for you to be a part of it in a way that you haven't been able to be before. And as a result of that, we expect some significant policy outcomes, including people who know from experience what it takes to get Indigenous kids through school in a way that has never happened before, is something surely worth a try. And one can say the same thing about, you know, including people who know what it takes to decrease rates of trachoma or other third world diseases that are prevalent in Australia only among First Nations communities, is something that's surely worth a try. And the whole idea of participatory democracy, rather than democracy as something that is supposed to exclude people, is an argument that can be expressed in fairly simple terms, perhaps even reduced to a bumper sticker. And it was disappointing not to see Noel Pearson take that opportunity on TV yesterday, and various other prominent advocates for the Voice campaign seem to be arguing at points of broader principle, which are all important as starting points. But I guess people want to know, is this going to make a difference? Is it fair? Is there any unfair consequence or burden that I'm going to have to carry as a result? And to be able to answer those questions, I think is important, and to get that through would be useful. And those international experiences and evidence from international studies that Mark referred to, I think would have helped the Yes case to have reflected on those perhaps before the campaign got underway.
It's interesting that the latest Redbridge research coming out last week indicated that one of the main reasons that people vote no on this, or say that they will, is that they say, you know, where are the details? We were talking about that just before with James as well, and with Michelle. What do you think about the prospect of the government releasing a draft bill at this stage of the campaign? Do you think that would allay that concern for which people may vote no, that they don't have details in their hands?
Well, I think the government's original argument against that was that it's the function of a constitution to set out principles. It's the function of the parliament to put those principles into law. And that makes sense at a constitutional level. But the government's lost the practical political argument on that one. So I think it would certainly not do any harm to publish a draft bill. The risk, of course, is that people look at the draft bill and we say we don't like the model, as happened with the Republican referendum. If the question had been kept more simply at a point of principle, should an Australian be Australia's head of state, it would have been a much easier proposition to advance. But I think, the polls are showing that the Yes case is in quite significant decline. The trend has been clear for some months. It's going to take some dramatic intervention to turn that around. And there is the risk it would make things worse. But to lose with 43% of the vote as opposed to 33%, well, does that really matter if there is that chance that it might make a difference?
Michelle, 99 and the referendum on the Republic does seem to haunt this referendum. You know, the fear of giving too much detail, as that might damage your campaign from the government's perspective. What are the lessons you think for the government from the 99 Republic referendum today for this one?
Well, I think that while obviously there are parallels being drawn, it's very different.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was any alternative in 99 really but to give detail, because you have a whole lot of questions about reserve powers and how the new head of state would operate and what sort of limits would be on them. And I think that really that, even though it helped bring it down, was an inevitable course to provide that sort of detail. And if there hadn't been detail, then all those questions would have been asked and would quite possibly have also turned negative and meant the referendum was defeated. My feeling is the government should have had a model for this and then perhaps say that this would be taken for consultation with Indigenous people, could be tweaked, but this was the basic model. But I think now it's too late. I think if they produced a model, then the opposition would jump on it and say, well, that's unacceptable for all sorts of reasons, so there'd be a further argument about how the thing would work. But I do think that people quite legitimately have had questions about how many people, how they're going to be chosen, and those, of course, haven't been able to be answered.
There is, of course, James, another way in which this referendum is different. It's the first in Australian history to occur in the heat, the toxic heat of social media. How do you think the Yes campaign is doing in responding to the negativity of that social media discourse? And what do you think it might be able to do better from your perspective?
Look, I think it's really hard to be an Aboriginal person campaigning for a voice right now. I think it really is. I think it's hard to be that Aboriginal person on social media in Australia generally,
yeah.
Let alone campaigning on an issue that's so fundamental and so important to us. And the online hate, the online discourse is really toxic. And in some cases, it's leaking into the main, it's leaking offline, you know, into people's actual lives. And people are, you know, taking steps back, but taking leave. There's folks getting death threats. You know, it's really quite toxic. So I think, you know, from personal experience, I think it's hard. It's definitely one of the challenges I think we could have been better prepared for. But also, we were never going to escape it. You know, I mean, especially once the coalition parties came out with their brand of messaging. And a lot of the brand of messaging they're pushing are, you know, identifiable falsehoods, things that are just blatantly untrue. You know, we're talking earlier about the level of detail. It's striking to hear the No campaign's conversations around detail when, you know, Peter Dutton was in cabinet the whole period this is being discussed and was there for every single one of the four or five reports that came out in that period. But they're still pushing this line that there's no detail. They're still pushing the line of dividing us by race. So I think it's really, you know, the online stuff is really toxic.
Mm.
And it really can get to you. You know, I personally am quite tired by it.
Mm.
It does really, really hit there. I'm not sure what we can do better for that. I think there's a responsibility, I think, of non-Indigenous peoples to step up a bit in some cases. There's a responsibility, obviously, on the social media companies to help better regulate the speech that's on their platform. You know, I mean, I have a little collection of these things. You know, I have a little collection of all the racist hate abuse I get. You know, not to any particular reason, it just sticks in your brain, right?
Mm.
One, you know, people threatening to put spears through my eyeballs or,
mm.
you know, hang me upside down by my feet or drag me behind in their truck. Like really, really, really violent stuff. And the online social media companies are like, oh, it's free speech. We can't do anything about that. Mm. They're engaging in their democracy. It's like, well, putting a spear through my eyeball is engaging with their democracy.
Mm.
Wasn't sure that was the kind of country I lived in, but okay, it's the country that, you know, Twitter is living in.
Yeah.
So I think that's. I think we need to do better at calling it out. You know, there's been some really. It's not just been online. It's obviously we've been seen some of the No campaigners, you know, say some really horrific things in person too. You know, people like Gary Johns from the No campaign, you know, saying some really quite distasteful and offensive things, and that needs to get called out a bit more. I think we need to actually have a really really low tolerance approach for this kind of stuff. Because when we let it slip, it moves the window of what's acceptable, I think, and it's only going to get worse from here.
Mark, we know that democracies worldwide are buckling under the weight of this information. You're from the UK, you know, you watch very closely the Brexit referendum. What's your reflection on the value of referenda today? I know that we have to work with them, but how can they work in this social media age? Referenda themselves?
Well, look, again, we get back to education, don't we? An understanding that different audiences respond more or less effectively to different channels of communication. But, you know, I've always been a great believer in the harm principle and the way in which we're operating our media system isn't in line with the harm principle. Because, yes, we have freedom of speech, but only as long as it doesn't undermine the freedoms of others. And in this case, this is clearly undermining James's freedoms. I think the restoration of the harm principle in terms of how we understand and regulate social media systems is going to be absolutely critical moving forward. And we now do have a cyber commissioner whose role, as you know, is to do just that. But I think that there's another issue going on here, which is it's the disconnect of this debate around the debate about the future of Australian democracy. It's almost as if the two things have been completely disconnected. Mm. And that's a real problem, because the reality is that, you know, I see this as a gateway to a longer conversation about the future of Australian democracy, right? That's what you're saying yes to, right? Now, it may be that there's a potential model, but I would hope as well other models would be out there as well, because I actually see local democracy as fundamental to addressing this issue. And, you know, local democracy has always been the Cinderella in Australian democracy. And yet it's fundamental in terms of developing a democracy that reflects people's sense of fairness and identity, right? So I actually think that that's the game changer is really that this, quite simply, is a gateway to a longer conversation about the future of Australian democracy. How can you be against that, given that we know from the polls and other devices that the majority of Australians are in favour of strengthening our democracy? The other point as well, and this is the experience from the UK, is that no one democratic reform works in isolation from others. So when you strengthen democracy in one area, you can reduce democracy in another, or at least you need to look at coordinating mechanisms that allow you to manage the spillover effects, right? Otherwise, you may well end up with a democracy that you don't want, right? So that's why this is so important to have an open conversation. And the open conversation, I think, is really quite clear, right? Australians, in theory, in my view, and again, the attitudinal survey suggests this, believe in fair go, right? Equality, right? But this isn't about fair go. This is about whether you believe that First Nations people should have a better go. I believe that they should have a better go, right? Because they have, in my view, historic claim of right to that better go. But there's no point hiding that. We've got to debate it, you know? And we've got to look at the institutional machinery that will enable that to happen, and look at the countries around the world that have actually designed consociational democracies in high politics with a very strong culture of local democracy, right? There are lots of successful exemplars where this has happened without major social discord and insurrection.
If I could just jump in from Margaret, I think it's probably going to make me seem younger than all of you here. There's this really good quote actually from Briggs, the rapper. He's been saying this for weeks, which is that the yes vote says that the conversation with Aboriginal people gets to keep going. We get to keep having this dialogue about our role in Australia, this country's future, this country's democracy. A no vote says the conversation's done. Mm. We're done with the conversation. We're closing that door. A yes vote says, at the very least, the conversation gets to keep going. We get to keep having this discussion as a nation as to the future of what this country looks like and the role of Indigenous peoples in this country. I think that's, to me, it speaks to Mark's point perfectly. And so it's always fun to quote Briggs. It makes you feel hip. But it's true. It makes a really good point that the no vote shuts that door to conversation. The yes vote, at the very least, allows that door to remain open.
Michelle, what do you think the government will do if they do have a failed referendum in terms of trying to keep that conversation going? Do you think it's possible if the referendum fails?
Look, I think it's very difficult to see a plan B, and you can understand why the government doesn't want to talk about it at this moment, but some Indigenous leaders are starting to talk about it, and I think more are starting to think about it. But I think whatever happens with this referendum, there needs to be a great deal more thinking at a practical level. There are immense problems here. They're what political scientists call wicked problems with no obvious solutions, but they're not reported properly. I think the media is totally failing in getting down onto the ground and going around and reporting the problems. It's easy to sit here in Canberra and pontificate about the voice debate. It's easy and it's comfortable. But they're not getting out into these areas enough, at least the mainstream media, maybe the specialist Indigenous media has been, but the rest of the media have not. And until we get better reporting, until we get better policy making, until our institutions carry through on a policy we already have for partnership in decision making on issues like health and education, housing and so on, we're going to make limited progress, voice or no voice. Mm. I mean, it's appalling, for example, that we're getting tuberculosis in remote Aboriginal community in South Australia. How much publicity has that got nationally? Not a lot. Surely that's completely unacceptable in this country.
Why do you think, Michelle, that the Australian traditional media is failing to be proactive in this way? What's changed?
Well, you know, issues come and go in the media policy issues. Years ago in the 70s, for example, I think there was a lot of coverage of Aboriginal affairs. There were a lot of policy disputes in Canberra and reporters were assigned to that area among their rounds. Now you've got less of that. I think it goes to the fact that there's a financial squeeze on the mainstream media, and if you're going to have, say, a couple of people out in the field, even posted to more remote places, it costs money, and it's frankly not clickbait, which is one of the disadvantages of technology. You can tell now what stories are read and what stories are not read. And, you know, the health of a remote community is probably not a red story. It's really bad, but I think that this is a reason why media companies are not willing to spend the resources.
Mm. Dominic, I want to come to you as a final point in question. You think a lot about the resilience of democracy, how democracies adapt and thrive in situations that put immense pressure on them and actually change the structure of the democracy and how it works. If we do see a failed referendum, how do you think that Australian democracy in Australia will survive and indeed even rehabilitate itself? Do you think it will?
Well, it will be an extraordinary test, because what a no vote will say is that the conversation's finished. The way in which First Nations people belong now on the periphery of democracy is okay. And it's a way of saying we're not sorry. Therefore, reconciliation too is finished. So it will be an act of extraordinary political leadership to bring reconciliation back onto the agenda, which needs to happen to support that democratic resilience and democratic amendment to allow people to be included. The Prime Minister, when he spoke about the referendum to a conference earlier in the year, spoke with a tone that was really saying, this is our white fella system. It's our job to decide what's best for you First Nations people, but as a matter of courtesy, we'll ask you what you think first. So it really wasn't an example of democratic reform or even a sense that democracy could be more resilient, could be more inclusive, that was coming through there. And that was at a time when Albanese was starting to read people's fears, I suppose, into the polls that perhaps a yes vote would do too much. He was really trying to pull back people's expectations. But I do think, as one who studies democracy fairly closely, that there are many ways in which democracy can work. It's not a simple system that has to work in one way. And if it departs from that single track, it's somehow weakened. Countries all around the world continuously look at how they can do things better. And the voice is not the only way, but it's part of a process of saying, well, of course First Nations people should get a fair go when they go to school. Of course they should have the same chance as anybody else of learning to read and learning to, completing their schooling. Of course they shouldn't be more likely to get sick than other people. Of course they should be more just as likely to receive effective health care when they go to hospital and those sorts of things. But we haven't worked out how to do that. And if the voice fails, one really obvious mechanism for helping us work out how to do that is closed. And there isn't a plan B. The government doesn't have one. The opposition parties certainly don't have one. And I think the yes side of the campaign are so invested in the efforts of the campaign, both emotionally and physically and intellectually, that for them to set out a plan B at this stage would be an admission of defeat. And of course they don't want to do that. But there's going to have to be an awful lot of thinking to bring things back on track and to bring democracy back towards its potential in an environment where racism is going to be emboldened without doubt. It's going to be a very difficult environment in which to have any conversation about First Nations people and rights and so on, and what a better go might mean as distinct from a fair go. The cultural and the intellectual environment is not going to be conducive to that for quite some time, one would think.
Well, thank you, Dom, and thank you everyone for joining us on this panel discussion today. Michelle Graddon, Professor Mark Evans, Professor Dominic O'Sullivan and James Blackwell. Mandungu, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.